Welcome to Cut the Bull, an insightful podcast which addresses the news of the day and the cultural issues plaguing our society, bringing logic and context to these topics and discussing solutions too real for mainstream pundits. Now, here are your hosts, Charles Love and Wilfred Riley.
Hello and welcome to Cut the Bull. I am Charles Love, alongside my co-host Wilfred Riley, and our guest this week is Deb Filmon. She is a K-12 education analyst and the host of The Reason We Learn. Deb, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I want to talk education, as we often do, from many facets and different sizes, and you bring a unique perspective to it. Whether they agree with you or not, people will definitely find you interesting. We have talked on this issue before, and you know, there's a lot of partisanship in, you know, on social media and in the news, even in education. People argue about a lot of things, about what's best for the kids, all the things you see in the news. But I think there's one silver lining, because there's going to be a lot of things, I'm sure, in our conversation that are going to be not as happy as they could be, right? Because the reality is not that great. But there's one thing that I can say is a positive thing. There's one thing everyone agrees on. Unfortunately, that thing is that the kids are failing. But they agree. I mean, it's the left and right, regardless of what you're talking about, they argue about different things that may or may not work. But they seem to all agree. They seem to use the same numbers and say our kids are failing. So we need to talk about both why that is, and if we really want to get out of the other end of the tunnel and make things better, we have to come up with some, you know, uncomfortable truths about what the problems are. And well, your unique thing is that you are willing to say that what both sides are saying and doing aren't really fixing the problem. So I guess spend a little time first saying why you think the kids are failing at such an alarming rate.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that we forgot why kids need to learn in the first place. And I don't mean be schooled. I mean, learn the things that we typically teach in a school. But the reason I call my channel The Reason We Learn is I hoped to remind people that we teach our children all of these various things, math, reading, all that, so they can live life on planet Earth, right? So they can grow and be, you know, self-sufficient, functioning adults, leave our homes and have a good life, whatever that's going to look like to them. You know, I would define that for my kids, and I would hope other parents would let their kids decide for themselves what that's going to be too. But they need to know how the world works and how to function in it. That means literacy, that means numeracy and certain things. And so I think we got away from that and we focused so much on this institution called schooling and got kind of sucked into a paradigm of learning equals X results, X scores, X grades, this kind of movement through a system at such and such a rate and so on. And, you know, parents today certainly didn't choose it. We're going back over 100 years, but schools were established and became compulsory because government decided it to be so, not because parents did, but we've forgotten that. And so we're all operating left and right. We're operating this paradigm of success or learning is attached to something called school. School is run by the government for 98 to 99% of kids in America. And that's perfectly fine. Like, we don't question that at all as even part of the problem. And so we got to stay in this little paradigm and fix it. And we never look at maybe the paradigm is wrong. Like, maybe we should step outside and say that the whole system itself from its inception was not really set up so that children would grow and thrive and learn, and was more designed to school them, as in train them to be certain things and certain kinds of people and think certain ways. And so what I think both sides get wrong is they don't step back from the paradigm and say, all right, what if we were starting from scratch and we wanted to have our kids be learned, you know, be educated human beings ready for life on planet Earth? Is this how we would do it? Like, is this the way we would do it or not? And because then we might be able to see the pieces that are broken. like what we want to fix. Right now, I see it as a power struggle between one side wants to control it one way and another side wants to control it their way. And it's the it that I want to question. Like maybe it is the wrong thing.
So, Will, to that, there's a lot of things that we can talk about there, and I hope we get to some of them. But the one I want to start with is you as an educator, you're educating young minds. The interesting piece that I want to start with is about the purpose of what we're doing, in that we're having a different fight. We'll talk about some of the other things later, right? Like right now, if you talk education anywhere in the country, it's always, either side of a gender argument, either side of race or DEI, and all those things are important, and then the stats and all that kind of thing. But when she talked about, she's getting to the core, and not like if you're going to solve a problem, getting to the root of the problem. And she's talking about what the purpose is, what you're trying to teach them. And probably we, I don't want to get too deep in history. I know you know, but then we'll spend eat up some of the time. But we can say, and I think that's what Deb was trying to lead to when you talk about from its inception, that we started off from what would be considered today more right wing, like, hey, this is the way we can get all the kids in school, and we can put morals on it, and we can put them in church, and we can teach them that kind of thing, and we can recite, we can make them patriotic, we can re recite scripture and things of that nature. So, things that a lot of people on the right would probably like today. Then it went to Dewey and Horace Mann and said, hey, we can control the minds, we can do all these other things with them. And then today, both of those things kind of went away, but it became teaching to the test. And right, we don't really care how much they know. Can they, recite stuff, or can we pass them through, or what does it look like to us and comparing other schools? So is she right that part of the problem is before you get to DEI or anything else, just the fact that what they're trying to do is flawed?
Yeah, I mean, well, arguably. So I looked through Deborah's. Do you prefer Deborah or Deb, by the way, or something else?
Deb's fine.
Deb,
That's fine. Okay. Yeah.
Either one. Just
So
don't call me Debbie and we're good.
I probably wouldn't have. All right. No. So I looked through Deb's website, and I think that the core question she's asking is actually interesting. I mean, she just outlined it. But what should the schools be doing in the first place? I mean, as both of you know, it's a big debate in higher education. I actually generally don't read education literature for a lot of reasons, but I mean, there are these kind of core paradigms, like should the schools make people into liberal citizens, people willing to contribute in this kind of Roman Grove fashion, or should they just make the kids employable, like you can go out there and get a damn job? Should they make them revolutionary? I have a big problem with this, but I mean, if you look at a Ferrera and people that are actually taught in ed schools right now, ed schools, interestingly, are probably the most radical and the most low, the lowest scoring of the college majors or the colleges in the technical sense. I don't think a lot of people know that. But so there's this whole debate going on. I mean, I lean toward the idea. I tend to be a somewhat amoral pragmatist when it comes to social structuring. Everyone will be shocked to learn, but I lean toward the idea that there are basic things like knowing how to read and do math that will apply toward both of the first two principles, which I think are valuable. Like that debate can continue probably forever. And my point would be right now the schools aren't doing those things, like at all. Like we brought Ian Rowe on the show once, and I remember we wanted to talk to him about black educational failures. And he said, well, we're all black men. It's not just a black educational failure. I mean, right now, the percentage of kids that can't read at the proficient level, so they're basic or they're below basic, it's 51% for whites, it's 60 whatever percent for Hispanics, 70% for blacks. So it looked like fatherlessness rates, to be quite honest. It was half of everyone was struggling with this problem. So, I mean, I think that's the issue. If you've got the two largest ethnic groups, 51% and 72% can't read, the question of what should the schools be doing at some metaphysical level when it comes to teaching men how to interact with women in a post-feminist world, let's shut up. Like, it's a fascinating question, but the first you need to do the baseline thing you're not doing.
Yeah,
I
and really quickly, one thing I always say to that is we can have debates about the things we like and don't like. But like everybody talk about activists. I go into the school, there's activists in the class, and my son is really young to be getting homework about what does he care about in the community. I don't really care. I don't think it's harmful. But my question is
Seems like a
always,
reasonable question, though. I mean, like, there's a distinction
but my point
between
is,
like parental neighborhood activism and like, what gender are you activism? Sorry
well,
about that.
yeah, but I'm saying, but do they even know? I mean, like, don't you need to know things before you can say what you care about? Right? You need
That's
to
fair.
know things. And then, like you said, you need to be able to read and write in order to communicate them. So maybe, I mean, I know they're doing both, but I'm saying is a heavy dose. Is an imbalance in how it's being weighed. What do you think, Deb?
Yeah, well, I was going to say you mentioned Horace Mann and Dewey, and what they tried to do was change education into what's called an affective model from a cognitive model. And what I think you're talking about, Will, is you're saying, there's certain basic things they need to be able to do, and I would assume as a college professor, you would like them to be able to think. By the time they get to be 18 years old, so they should be able to take the facts that they know and be able to conceptualize and, integrate, and that helps you create and innovate and all those kind of things, not just have a list of facts that they know. But if you focus at the early grades, even if you taught them to read, which they don't do, as you pointed out, but let's say you did, but you focused on feelings, you focus on affect and how how everything makes you feel, how you care about this, that, or the other that you're reading about, rather than what do you think about it? Why do you think it's important? Why did this happen after that happened? And so on. You end up with kids who maybe could read and could do math, but they lead with feelings. So their approach to life, the lens, if you will, through which they look at life and the world is not rational or cognitive, it's more on this feeling side. And I did a little video about mindset today. You probably hear about growth mindset versus fixed mindset. And you'll hear this often in school. We want to teach our kids to have a growth mindset. On the surface, this sounds good. Okay, so they're not doing so well in the reading and the math. We teach them a growth mindset. That means, oh, I know I need to persevere and try harder and I can. Whereas fixed is like, I can't. Well, that sounds great until you then also hear them talk about victim oppressor narratives at very young ages, the gender stuff you mentioned, which is literally a fixed mindset. If you look at the world as divided in two, how do you square that with growth mindset? I can, except for this systemic racism. I'll do better tomorrow unless these bad people are in my way. So they're in conflict. And so I'm not sure they can teach the things you're talking about because they're kind of breaking the child's brain at a young age when what it needs to be allowed to do is think. It needs to be able to engage with information, take it in, apply it. Grades K through five, there is a lot of memorization. There is a lot of building up your knowledge. Charles, you asked, don't you have to know things first? That's called the hierarchy of knowledge. Before I can think at another level, how and why questions, I have to have a basis of knowledge. I have to have a basic understanding of, how things actually work. And they're not doing that either. We jump ahead to the feelings and higher order thinking and analytical thinking when kids are not developmentally ready for it emotionally or cognitively, and they have no knowledge. And this causes confusion. It causes some fear, anxiety. I think it's messing them up emotionally. And that gets in the way of them learning. So now, if I sit and try to read, and it's not that easy for me, but I've also got all this anxiety about the world is a scary place and climate change and all these things, am I going to be able to work through and persevere through how hard my reading is or that math that's not exactly easily accessible to me? Probably less well. So, this is what I see as a problem. We are not respecting the cognitive development of the child, and we're trying to go for a model that is of a different worldview.
Okay, let me ask you this. You may have answered that in that, but I said earlier that we were going to talk about what the left and right gets wrong. So
Sure.
let's start with the left because people would not probably not expect at least the two of us to say what the right gets wrong. So they'll be
Sure.
surprised there. But the left, did you
Sure.
cover
Getting
that or is there?
increasingly mad at the right, honestly,
Right.
but that's a different
Oh,
topic.
same, but for different reasons.
Right. So what would you say is the reason why the left is getting it wrong and hurting and not finding the solution and helping the kids?
I think the left is very ideological, more so than the right, and is really using the children, exploiting the children for an activist purpose, and refuses, at least in the education circle. Okay, so I'm talking about the ed schools, I'm talking about from PhDs on down and the unions and so on. They see these children as junior activists that they can socially engineer to achieve their desired result politically. I think that's in a nutshell. And I don't care what you label it, whether it's CRT, DEI, gender, it doesn't matter. they'll rebrand it tomorrow. It's the main thing is the social engineering away from an individualist mindset that was the mindset of the founders of this country and the Constitution and so on, towards a collectivist mindset where you are your brother's keeper. You have to sort of subjugate your own needs or wants or whatever to the collective. It's a very Soviet mindset, basically. And I see it in everything I read. That's what the left gets wrong, is they're actually, in my view, and I know it's a controversial thing to say, I think they're abusing the children.
Will.
Cognitively.
So, Will, is she right? And if so, what percentage is that and what percentage is just power and control? Because it's good to have all the money and have the union and be able to, you know, write your own check and just say something. The kids need more money and get 50,000 new teachers or whatever the case may be. So I'm sure there's a balance, but what would you think about that?
Well, what could you rephrase the question? What do you, so right, you're like, saying,
is she right?
I agree with Deb about the messianic perspective right. that left-wing activists have toward kids, but
much of it is that and how much of it is just plain old greed of power?
Oh, so how much of it is just like, we do the same if like the center right business right. team is in power. And teach them America's the best country in the world. John well, Galt, you little bastards. I mean, like, are. I mean, that's, I mean, I would agree with those two statements actually, but see that. So I think that there are levels to this. I mean, I would agree with the comment that I think we've all made that in general, left-wing quasi-revolutionaries tend to be far more political about day-to-day things in life. And this is actually a comment, like the personal is political, everything is political. And this is one of a lot of manipulative word games that these people engage in, right? So it's true in some sense that everything involves an element of politics. Like when I teach a lesson about Abe Lincoln, there are going to be some assumptions that everyone has. You can assume that Honest Abe was a good man or a bad one, so on down the line. But there's obviously a difference between that and intentionally doing what Ferrere does, for example, which is use math lessons to make political points. Like, you know, students, how far did you drive to get to school today? Do you notice that some of your parents weren't able to afford cars? That's what a left-wing activist means by politics. So I think that everyone is going to politicize the arenas of engagement in their society. But I don't think that I generally see anywhere else what the woke left does. And one final thing, there's one exception, which is religion, actually. And John McWhorter, many people have pointed out the similarities here, but I think that people that believe in faith-based ideologies that can't stand up to rational debate, like, you know, the Jesuits get them later. There's very serious religion out there, Hindu Vatna philosophy. But if you just want people to believe in the straight up God made the world in 6 days version of Christianity or Islam, the people you start with are children. It's very important that you get that into their heads at an early age. It's like the old line my mom once told me, morality is what I'm going to tell you before you turn 7. You just really want to hammer that crap into them so that at some level they always believe it. The tall person that was never wrong, that protected them from attackers, told them that. And that's what wokeness is. That's why you have the symbols. You have a literal dancing unicorn used to tease gender. You have guns and bows and other fire weapons used to illustrate bisexuality. Like you're doing exactly what the God boys do, except with something a lot less useful. So I don't think we would do quite the same thing, Charles. No. I mean, we, you know, teach them how to value money or something, but I had to ask the question. No, but like some of this stuff, like the pleasure-based sex education movement. I talked about this with a couple of other male educators the other day. Like, I think you have to have a certain, well, there are two reasons you could be very interested in doing this. One is that you're a pedophile. But the other would be if you're genuinely interested in taking those legal risks to sit there and talk about BDSM with small children or something, there's a very deep commitment you've made to a personal view of the world. And you want to communicate that to kids. And I don't feel that way about too many things. Maybe bravery. Maybe IQ training, but nothing, very little at the level of partisan politics. You know, oil prices should be X or something like that.
Well, I hate to take go up on the side on a tangent, but, you know, we go where the conversation goes. And I'm assuming you two saw the Joy Reid Tiffany Justice interview.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that very few things fascinate me. But that did mostly because I expect her to come from the left. I kind of had an assumption what Tiffany would say. I didn't know the whole interview would be about books. It's funny. That's the only thing they wanted to narrow it down to. I guess that's the thing they thought they had to gotcha on. But what surprised me, and in some evil way, I was kind of like, that was such a weird attempt that I have to give you credit for the attempt, but it was so bad. Was the point where she said, where Tiffany's talking about the things in the book. They picked the specific book, All Boys Aren't Blue. They were talking about the things in the book, anal rape and wearing a strap-on dildo with a minor, should they be in school. And this was supposed to be a gotcha question. And Joey says, who's the main character in that book? Right? And her point was, and I mentioned it to a friend who saw it, they thought the point was something different. I'm like, no, the point was to say, how dare you take that out of context and pick it out of a book? You haven't even read the book, so you don't even know what it meant. You're just picking it out because you don't like that part. And it seems so weird to me because, what I thought in that moment was, okay, let's say a black parent sat down and had a 15 chapter book and they were reading the book and they got to chapter two. And it's like, niggers are inferior to whites, right? They're not as smart. They're dangerous. We should just kill all the niggers. So I told everybody in the neighborhood to let's go kill the niggers. And then they started talking about how they were going to do it. And the parent slammed that book shut and said, I want this book out. Joy would never tell that parent, but you didn't read the whole book,
Right.
right? Who's the main character of the book? And then she said, what if that book spoke to some child and they needed that information? Well, they could buy it. The parents could get it from the public library. But that was her argument. But she could never say that it was bad when Tiffany asked her, well, do you think that's appropriate? She never said yes. And then she tweeted it out at MSNBC and they put X's for strap-on dildo. So they wouldn't even put it in a tweet, but they're telling you that it's okay with the kids. So that's kind of what you're getting at, Will. It's like, if you're not a pedophile, you said there's only two categories, pedophilia, or you're using this as a kind of a culture, right? You're using this as a point. And she could not bring herself to just say, this doesn't make sense. I don't like anything about you, lady, but I'll say you're right on that. I didn't know that was in the book.
Well, you're
I
getting
will
this.
say that,
I'm sorry.
go ahead, Will.
no, well, I definitely this should be fairly brief. So actually, we talked with Tiffany Justice about this on the show, and this is something I'm closer to her side of the position here, but I actually do think that this is something that is going to become the core of a lot of silly fights in school board meetings. And I think you can make this point about, for example, genderqueer with most writings. I mean, like a book that's in my school library is The Washing of the Spears, which is about the war between the British and the Zulu. And that's actually a book that I quoted during our conversation with Tiffany Justice. Like, we were tripping over the intestines of our fallen fellow warriors, this kind of stuff. I think anything read in that format could sound potentially very disturbing. Like, I've looked at Genderqueer in passing, and it's about a 200-page graphic novel. It has two sexual panels in it. Should that be in a middle school library? Like, if I were voting, no. But I think it is very easy to trot that out and say, we're pushing porn in the face of these kids. Like, I mean, in reality, when I was in high school, there were standard sex education books, like the old marriage manuals that were in the school library. And I read through them. And as a guy, I actually found it pretty useful to see, oh, this is what a clitoris is. This is what consent is. That's a pretty big one for like the high school athletes out there. Like, all that stuff, I don't think was particularly harmful. So I guess
I
my
think.
comment would be debated at the board meeting or something, but just going on TV and Tiffany doesn't do this, but like I've seen multiple people wave like pictures of dildos at like Bill Maher, like we know what one looks like. Is that really what's going on? And if
Yeah.
so, why not cut that page out? There
Right.
are plenty of
And I think
questions you
this
could
is the
ask back.
same because Joy made the rules of engagement. It was her show. She decided to pick the book and say, let's talk about this book. And so Tiffany says, but that
Yeah,
book
Joy Reid's
says
not
this.
very bright. That's not the one I would have picked, as opposed to like To Kill a Mockingbird or some shit. But
Yeah, there you're getting to. There's two. First of all, you're about to segue into what the right gets wrong, which I want to touch on in a second.
Yep.
But also, you're getting to something important, which is the question we're not asking, whether it's related to these books or whether because they have porn in them, or even if they just were poor quality books, which is happening a lot too, is my question for people like Joy is how she says, what if a kid needs this, et cetera? Okay, well, there's a lot of talk about kids who are abused or kids who are fearful at home, whatever. Well, teachers are mandatory reporters. And what comes with that job, I know because I once did it, is a certain amount of training, or there used to be, in recognizing some of the signs of abuse, one of which is a kind of hyper focus and interest insects that can be, depending on the age of the child and the sex of the child, male or female too, that is a factor. The kind of questions they're asking, the persistence with which they're asking, and the amount of material they're consuming can be a warning sign. Because what they tend to try to look for is something that makes it okay, what's happening to them. Because, of course, it's this terrible cognitive dissonance that's happening, and that can be a sign that something is amiss, and that the normalization of this in schools can be concealing a fair amount of real abuse that's going on, and or making it seem, making them more vulnerable to people at home where they might have otherwise said, get away from me, or told somebody, you might have thought, well, this is like normal, right? So since we don't know, the question I ask people like Joy is, but if you're wrong, if there is equal potential, let's say, for this to prove harmful to kids, why do it? Aren't there better ways to help kids learn about their bodies? Aren't there better, or at least equal, aren't there better ways to teach them about adult situations and so forth? And I just want to evaluate materials that come into the classroom or the school library based on their value in, that we could agree on as a community that this is probably beneficial or more likely to be beneficial for more kids. And that's what I see wrong with the books. The flip side of that is the focus on the books, which I think Will is highlighting. And that's one of the things I believe the right gets wrong. And initially, when it first started, and people said, hey, look, these books are in the library and they're prominently displayed and so on, I think it was worth calling out and asking questions. Why so much and why is this happening? But then it became performance art. Then it became a kind of thing where parents were showing up at school board meetings, yelling at the school board, and reading graphic parts of the books. When, to your point earlier, most of the kids don't read proficiently. Are we really worried they're going to the library to check out these books? And the Streisand effect is going to come into play. Now they're all going to know about the books, whether they were before or not. Then you talk about Paulo Freire. Well, what is the point of having all this material in the school? It's to generate those conversations. It's generative, which was his whole argument. So if they place these things prominently in the school and the parents call attention to it and they constantly fixate on it, don't you think more kids are going to start asking questions? And that opens up the dialogue with the teacher. Well, the kids are asking. The kids want to know. The kids asked us to go over this book. So I think putting all the attention on the book instead of on the literacy factor, instead of on judging the quality of the literature that they're being assigned, this is stuff in the library they could take out on their own. But what are they reading in the classroom? Focus there. Focus on the stuff that's assigned to them. Focus on whether they're getting those skills. And I think this is what the right does wrong. It grabs hold of the salacious thing that gets a lot of airplay, gets a lot of attention. And then I'm sorry to say, makes it so easy to make them the butt of the jokes and focus on them. They're the story as opposed to the kids being the story. And I've been saying this now. A year ago, I wrote an article. And I warned people. I said, please read this before you go to your next school board meeting and do a book challenge, because I think it's had its day. We need to move on because we're way past the point of diminishing returns with it. I'm not saying that it's good. We should put more books in like this in the library. That is not my point. I got plenty of people going, you're a lefty commie perv, whatever. I said, no, that's not it. What it is that we need to get back to the conversation about what they should be doing and what they should be learning, and don't paint every teacher out to be, a pedo.
Right.
That what they mostly are is, in most cases, they're overburdened with things they shouldn't be doing. They are getting into areas of counseling and mind stuff that they aren't trained
And
for and really
feelings.
in feelings. And we've moved so far away from the core mission, especially at the elementary and middle school level, that you're attacking people who at most you could say are incompetent. And I say that with love. Like, I'm not trying, there are some wonderful teachers, but there are also some teachers who are just outclassed. They're not where they should be. And we need to get back to looking at what they should be doing.
Well, there's another thing that I'm sure you agree on, but you mentioned that one because it segued from the other topic.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the biggest thing that the right gets wrong. You know what
No,
I
but
think the
it's one of
biggest thing
them,
that gets,
and I
you
was
know what
just
the biggest,
piggybacking on what he said, so.
right? You know what I think the biggest thing that they get wrong is? You have a conversation with them. You talk about all these problems. They can't read, bullying and discipline problems, all these problems. And you say, what should you do? What do they say, Deb?
School choice.
In some ways, not intentionally. So these are some of my buddies. I like what they do, so don't get mad at me. But a lot of people will say, yeah, that's all you do. Take your kids out, find a place for them to go, homeschool, and put them in another school, which is totally fine. If you're talking about saving your kid, your family comes first. That's totally fine if that's what you want to do. But I'm saying, Deb may enter the stat, just saying it's around, but it is actually close to that. You said 98 to 97, 98. It is in the 90s percent of kids that are in school age kids in America that are in public school. Yes, there's a way, right? It's like how close you're looking at it, right? So yes, there's a movement towards private school choice and all these other things. That's true. But in the grand scheme of things, the ocean wouldn't even feel the ripple, right?
No.
So I tell them that if you get everything you want, the best case scenario in all 50 states had the voucher program and did all this, maybe best case scenario, you get it down to 75%, maybe 70. You're really good, you get it to 70. That's still the vast majority of kids in public school. So you didn't fix the schools. Actually, you make the school worse because you probably took the more concerned parents out, right?
Well,
So
they also
that's
have
what I think the bigger
this
issue
false
is.
notion of competition. And it's you can only have competition if it's a free market. It's not a free market. So if the money is going through the government in the first place, like all the money is going to the government, and now the government is just going to establish a new bureaucracy to redistribute some of it to different channels, that's not really a real competitive market.
Well,
You've
see, I
got,
thought we would get to the money part later. I thought, which
okay,
is fine. No, you brought it up. We can go there.
but what I'm saying is you're right, there aren't enough. But because they're
I'm
not
also
enough,
saying that they're ignoring the public school. So most of the kids are in public school. We can have a whole 15-minute conversation about the money in schools, about the private schools, whether they're in line with your ideology anyway, and all that. I'm saying that all that's perfect in my scenario too. The money's not going through the government. The schools that they get to, the choice to go to are perfect and pristine. You still have 75% of the kids in the
right.
terrible schools, and you made them worse.
No, I totally agree. I'm just saying that if it were a true education freedom movement where every parent, and I know you're saying there's not enough schools, but hear me out. So the parent didn't have to wait to find a school. It was like, here, you keep your money.
Right, here's your money. You do whatever you need to do.
You do what you need to do with it. I actually do believe in that scenario where it's not like, well, we're going to reserve, 90% of the money for the public schools, then we'll divvy up the other 10%. If it was just like, hey, take it where you want to go, it's all the money. I do believe that you would see the market flooded. Now, I'm not saying they'll all be great, but you would see things open up to where there would be enough opportunities in schools and means of educating the kids in a better way. In ways that were community-based, in ways that understood the local kids and understood the parents, and the parents had more influence and so on. And I know I sound like Pollyanna when I say that. Everybody rolls their eyes and laughs at me. Okay, super fine. That's great. But I just want to make sure people understand that that's what education, liberty, and real choice looks like. If you don't want it or you're not ready for it, that's fine. Say so. But this other ersatz choice thing is what you're describing. It's not. It's just opening up a tiny little trickle of, here you go. And even there aren't enough schools because they still have such a stranglehold on the education economy. And so I just don't think it's going to solve the problem. Add to it that the teachers are coming from the same pipeline,
That
so
was the other
they're
thing,
all
yeah.
trained
So
the
they're all
same
still getting this.
way. I mean, I don't know what who you want teacher choice, really. Like what who do you think is going to fill these magical schools? And so then what you end up with, and this is what really chaps my head, and the right gets wrong more than the left. EdTech's going to fix it. AI and EdTech, and we'll put the kids in front of this whiz bang new app, and this guy's got an app, and that one's got an app, and my business and your business, and we got a cool new entrepreneurial thing. And I am seeing some people that are in my space overselling EdTech and like adaptive AI to customize for the kids. And I see that much more on the like center right than on the left, which still has all the teachers to keep employed. And I think that's very, very wrong. And every time I see it, I'm just like, no, please don't do that, because I would rather keep the system we have. And that says a lot for me because I'm not a government person, but I would rather keep it and somehow come up with a way to get better teachers. I do believe if you're going to send kids into an environment to learn, like a school, your teachers need to be humans and they need to be top-notch and they need to be different than what we have. But I think it's a relational job. I think it can, when it's done well, it's life-saving. And I don't want to see humans replaced by machines, especially for K through like 8th grade. I really feel strongly about
Well,
that.
everybody likes a good app, but I'm gonna get back to that. I'm gonna play a clip I want you to respond to. But first, I want to hear what Will has to say about what he thinks the right gets wrong from K through 12 education.
Well, I think you guys have actually done a good job of highlighting probably the three biggest problems with the right in general. One, I would break them down as one, there's kind of a prudish refusal to say normal things. That's what we started with, like the idea of competitive, what used to be called church lady. The guys are just as bad with this. Focus on like being more pure. So like the whole thing with sex education books in the school. Like most people start having sex around 16 or 17, or at least seriously dating. And that's perfectly normal and healthy. That's kind of what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to have a serious girlfriend in high school and go to college and party a little and get married. Like you're supposed to know how to ask people on dates and do these normal things. So and in fact, it's a big problem for young men in particular that they don't now. This is something that I've helped mentees with. Like turn off your phone, go out, go to her house, do this. This is how you make a dinner reservation. The inability to do these basic things is actually a very serious problem. And this focus on like, we need kids learning less about how to interact with one another, consensually sleep together. So, like, I don't really know if that should be the focus of a social movement. So, that's one thing that the right has always had as a problem, sort of Jerry Falwell influence on ordinary behavior when they should be focusing on closing the border. Second thing that I wrote down is a tendency to highlight kind of, and I'll combine two things. Tendency to highlight small vices to attack essential systems. There is still very much that kind of Davy Crockett, at least in people's minds, personality and perspective on the right. So, like when I log on to Twitter, I have a mostly bro 25 to 45 year old, mostly male following. And people keep saying things like, yeah, we need to just give up on the schools. Don't go to prep school. Don't go to college. Get a job as a plumber. And I have no disrespect for plumbers whatsoever. I mean, we just wrote a pretty substantial check to one in my house. But I don't really think that's a sustainable model for the majority of society. You can't point to the fact that there are two arguably pornographic, more realistically hard R books in an entire school library and say, well, we need to move away from the public schools. What you guys are saying is absolutely correct. And I checked out the figure while we were talking. It does seem to be in my state about 97% of kids just go to standard publics. So saying, well, the public school system has fallen. You hear this a lot on the harder right. California is done. Education has fallen. This idea in practice would mean abandoning 97% of the people in society, the children, to your political opponents. What does that mean for your movement down the road? Well, it means complete and utter defeat, of course. So in reality, there have to be coherent right-wing models that are based around something other than stealing money and trading floor style environments. I know a lot of the guys that are in the app development game used to work with some of them. It has to be based around something more than triggering the libs, quote unquote, and being the biggest edgelord you can be. You have to have coherent ideas. I mean, I think, Deb, you just gave a coherent idea how you could greatly expand school choice, but you need to hear more practical things like this. And we're starting to see this, by the way, across a ton of fields. I still read some of the defense intelligence press. I just noticed that white military recruitment has dropped by about half. And a reason people cite for that is the right-wing media ecosystem. So there's something deeply bizarre about the quote-unquote patriots telling people not to go fight for the country. And morality, even aside, like in giant multiracial empires, it's usually not a good thing for your group not to be represented in the armed forces. So those are some things the right gets wrong. The biggest one is attacking systems you need.
Right.
Lots of Green Mountain Boys bullshit. Like, no, you can't just get rid of the public schools.
Right. And to that point, again, I often have to qualify what I say with saying that I'm not against school choice. I think it's important. I think people should have the right
I
to
mean,
go wherever you
morally, we kind of have to support it, right? We can't say we're like against it.
Right.
It's
That's like
just
against
that
choice. How can you be
the
against choice?
model of implementation, like the way they're kind of going about it. And I'm concerned, I'm genuinely concerned, and there is precedent for it, that it will more quickly allow what private market there is to be turned public.
So in other words, hold your thought right there. That's exactly the clip I want to play, because I was at a Moms for Liberty event. You know, I know I'm being attacked for it last Thursday. And my buddy Corey DeAngelis was there talking about school choice. Why are you making that face, Steph? Don't be like that. And
he
I went, what?
Me. He hates me. No, literally.
I was like, Corey, why does he hate Corey, you? He's like one of the most lovable people in the
He's a nice guy. What did you do to him? What did he call you?
He called me dangerous.
Why are you being dangerous?
I asked him. I openly asked him questions.
Let me play the clip.
Okay, go ahead.
And then you can.
That's fine.
Oh my God!
In the dangerous.
Oh, I'm in trouble here. Okay, let me see. So he was talking. He got a question. I want you to hear the question and the response. Let me make sure. I always forget to share this now.
One question I have is to Corey about school choice. Some of the critics about school choice say that if you get government money, there's strings attached. So what are the strategies to avoid that? Because then that takes away freedom as well, and there'll be indoctrination because it's government-led.
So Thomas Sowell once famously said there are no solutions, only trade-offs. Basically, there's no perfect solution, but school choice is the best option we have in front of us. This argument makes perfect the enemy of the good. We already have millions of children across the country stuck in government-run schools where they're learning that big government solutions are the best policy to go forward. So if you have more kids going through the government-run school system today, they'll be more likely to vote to regulate private and home education tomorrow. School choice reduces the likelihood of that happening in at least three ways. One, you have an escape valve. At least you have some families that can go to schools that are aligned with their values. Maybe they'll be less likely to indoctrinate kids with big government ideology. And so they'll be less likely to vote to regulate private and home education out of existence tomorrow. Two, politics is all about coalition building. Politicians respond to power and organized interest groups. If you have more families benefiting from private and home education through school choice, you have a broader coalition to fight back against authoritarian overreach in the future. Three, if you have more people benefiting from private and home education through school choice, you make the concept more mainstream. If it's more mainstream, the rest of society will be less likely to think of it as some icky thing that only a few people are doing in the corner, and they'll be less likely to call to regulate it in the future as well. I've also heard arguments that this is a way for Democrats and the left to infiltrate the private schools and to inject CRT into private schools too. But if the Democrats are actually, if that's their secret plot, well, then why do they all vote against it? And then Randy Weingarten, who we've mentioned too many times tonight, have made the same argument about school choice regulating the private schools. Is she saying that because she's some anti-government libertarian? No, she's a big government socialist, wants to keep her gravy train going and trapping kids in failing government schools. So this is the best solution we have. It's you don't want to miss the forest for the trees. And the government has already regulated private and home education historically. In Oregon, they outlawed private and home education in 1922. In 1925, thankfully, Peers for Society of Sisters, the U.S. Supreme
Court. So is he wrong?
He said a lot of things that I would tend to agree with, but he didn't answer the question. So I kept waiting for the answer to the question and it didn't come. But, you know, it's like saying, and water is wet and water is wet and water. Yes, politics is about coalition building. Yes, the more people who are going outside the system does build a bigger group of people that make it mainstream and so forth. Like all of these statements are true, but he missed your point, Charles, which is, this presupposes the parents who get the money are going to find those other places to go. It also presupposes that those places they go are not already left-leaning. It also presupposes that, you know, the union's telling the truth. Now, we know the union fought and fought and fought Common Core. Now they act like they invented it. Okay, so, I mean, unions and the left have a long, long history of pretending to fight things that they actually had already planned how they were going to cope with because they saw them coming. And what we have to understand is that education in America is inherently political because it's paid for with tax dollars. There's no way around that. There are going to be voters on both sides voting for things. So if you set up school choice and you have these ESA dollars or however you're going to pay for it, that voters on both sides of the aisle in whatever state you're in get their say on election day to say, I want it regulated this way. I want it regulated that way. I want it done this. I want it done. That's just the way it is. Now, I understand what he's saying. You build the coalition. But that's if you had the number of seats and the number of spaces in the schools that presumably are more conservative anyway. Just because a person said, we know this with the private schools now, just because somebody sends their kid to private school doesn't make them right leaning. Most of your NAIS schools, your most Tony private schools are hard left. They're more left than any public school in California. So
let's talk about a couple of these things in fairness to Corey. He can't defend himself. So I'm going to play the Corey.
No. And I'm not trying to attack him. I'm just saying asked, what's the strategy?
I know, but that's the question.
He didn't answer.
I think he did ask the question because he didn't really. Did he say strategy? I have to hear it again.
He said, what's the strategy to limit the strings attached?
And he said he can't. He said there are none, but you don't do school choice because you're still going to help some people. You can't help everybody. He said you can't guarantee that won't happen. But his argument was that it's going to happen anyway.
Questions for Corey were, what are you putting in the bills? So every question I asked was very specific. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I mean, I'm not trying to make if you acknowledge that this isn't all the way good.
Right. Which then, I think he did.
Then tell me how you are advising the politicians you work with, because he does work with them, and the policymakers to craft these bills in such a way that they are a little tighter so that you have things in there that make it much harder, not just for the existing administration, but for subsequent administrations and for the turn of the political cycle to start encroaching and turning this otherwise good thing that could grow and get bigger and better into something that just becomes an octopus that chokes it.
And then a second thing that he mentioned, that you didn't disagree with those. You said the only thing you disagreed about was the answer to the question. But the coalition building
that's fact of life.
Right. And the part about getting the once the parents are in, I mean, I'm saying if you look at specifically what's happened in Chicago, right, because they had the choice and then they pulled the rug out from under them. So now those people who had an opportunity to be in better schools and now they took it away from are all trying to find people and lawyers and groups. And they're clamoring. They just had some rally on Sunday because they're trying to get back what they lost. So I guess his argument there is also true that if more people saw what the other options were and what's different from the public schools, then maybe more people would consider it.
But right? How many more? I keep wondering if Corey has looked at the numbers. So when he makes these statements, and he's like I said, there's nothing wrong in what he said. He's correct in terms of in the theory of how it would work. But I live in this weird place called reality where I look at numbers that are like, I look at the existing, like number of seats, number of buildings, number of schools, and how many more do we need? How much money do we need to pull out of this public system to create that before like a Chicago can do what Chicago did?
You need momentum. Right. So we're running short on time. So let me ask you this. So do you think it's a net plus or minus? So do you think because of all those problems, you should just not do it? Or do you still think it's better than nothing? And
yeah, obviously it's going to vary state to state, but yeah, obviously I can't say I'm like against it. I'm just very concerned.
And
I'm going to be watching.
Why do you call you dangerous?
Because I asked these kinds of questions where I said, what are you putting in the bills? And he just kept coming back with, you're making the perfect, the enemy, the good. He just kept hammering at that. And I was like, no, I want to keep the good.
Right.
Like, I want to actually have this be the good.
Right. I don't want to judge it because I wasn't there, but it sounds like it's a case where somebody has that one small piece that they're working on. And so since that's his only focus, he's not focusing on all the other noise in education. It's the school choice. That obviously he's pushing hard on it. So anything that he thinks may distract, maybe that's why it was. Will, what did you think of the clip and that concern that it's still being, when you use the voucher, you're still using government money. So the left, they are crafty. They will find a way to skew it in their favor somehow. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think points on both sides when it comes to, you know, Deb v. Corey. But I mean, the basic point there is obviously accurate. I mean, so if you move, and I think this is another thing that the right kind of gets wrong. I don't want to hammer the right more than the left, but most of our guests are from the right. Yeah, so we often kind of bro out, talk about policing, lock them up. You know, these are obvious points. So one advantage that the left actually does have is that on average, at the upper levels of society, they tend to be a bit smarter. I mean, there's a joke from Charles Murray. They have all the English teachers, you know, and you often see this come into play. And you see this come into play with like the DEI fight, where people will hammer out. You see people show up, solid two-button suit from the various hardworking communities around the country, and, you know, get into the ledge and hammer out something like a bill that absolutely bans any, what's the term in Florida, any labeled DEI program. If I were the strategist on the other side, I would then just call my program cultural competence training in the paradigm of total quality, something I just pulled out of my ass, but it took me exactly 3 seconds. That's right. How people, but yes, I mean, and this, we all know, that's how people in the business world, the education world, at any level of seriousness are going to respond to this. Yep. So I love Corey, but these are questions that have to be answered. Like, to what level would charter schools be dependent on state and federal funding? One, what amount of, what level of requirements similar to those in standard publics would be attached to that? Two, I mean, my argument as a GOP strategist or a conservative strategist would be to try to get the requirement load, the red tape load, reduced as much as possible, while my op is trying to do the opposite. So I noticed both of you guys at various points have mentioned that the problem is getting teachers in these schools. I don't know if you were automatically assuming this, but people often say that as though teachers have to be people with ed degrees.
No. In fact, please no.
But that's what I'm saying.
But the teaching profession has gone down in esteem so much, and especially in private and charter schools, the pay is quite low. They don't pay. And so that, now I'd go in a heartbeat. If Ian Rowe had a school that I could get to within an hour of my home, I'd be like on his doorstep begging him for a job. And maybe he wouldn't even hire me, but
come to North Carolina.
I would love that, you know, and I'm not looking to make millions of dollars. I'm not looking I didn't go into teaching in the first place to make money. But when you have people going to college and thinking to be a teacher, I need to go to ed school. So they do. And the others who don't go to ed school don't want to be teachers. Like, it's not even in their thought process. And they don't imagine that the existence could be anything good or wonderful for them because they're not seeing it. They don't really see examples held up of it. I think we have a teacher shortage as it is, even of the not so great teachers, that I think it's going to be really challenging. Now, obviously there are ideas that are floated, like bring people out of retirement, get subject matter experts to float in as like floaters from careers, like take a sabbatical from what you're doing and come in and teach science, let's say, or whatever. And I think there's some great ideas floating around to kind of fill those, you know, teaching spots. But as I said, you need momentum for something like school choice to do all the things that Corey rightly says could happen and would be great. You need a number that I'm concerned we haven't been doing enough work on that side to build fast enough, both schools and
that's
teachers.
Like, we're kind of bouncing ideas back and forth. I don't think it would be necessarily all that difficult to round up a fairly solid number of teachers. I mean, thinking of our graduate students at a fairly solid state U, I mean, the number of them that have found an academic job right off the block, maybe 1 in 5. I mean, I don't want to reveal exact data, but that's a brutal market right now.
No, I agree.
If you're hiring for a prep or charter school, I think that there's a whole pool of people. If you were to advertise in any weekly in Brooklyn or down here in like central metro Lexington, like, are you a smart young person who feels stuck in your job? Would you be willing to work for just $25 an hour? I think there would be lines of people with their blue books outside every one of those schools. I would almost guarantee that.
You're probably you're probably right, but I want to remind you guys of something, and this is something I'm a tutor as well as a teacher and a homeschool parent. A lot of the people seeking school choice are seeking it because their kids are suffering and failing. So they're not all kindergarten students. And so sometimes these kids, while they'll have wonderful parents who are like, I want to get you into a school where you can do better. We need teachers also with special skills. Taking a kid, for example, who's 10, but who is not even reading at a third grade level. They could be. In other words, they don't have a learning disability. A lot of these kids, they don't have a learning disability. They are just that far behind. So we need not just, hey, come be a fourth grade teacher. We need people who can come in and remediate and actually address some of the issues. And they're not just academic issues. What has happened in some of the schools the parents are so eager to get the kids out of is a level of bullying and anxiety development and all these things that school choice is not the panacea for that either. We have a generation of children who are at to varying degrees, and obviously not every single one of them, kind of damaged. I mean, there's the learning loss.
Well, I think this is the perfect, this is kind of the last comment for me, because like we're, I know it's Charles about to talk as well, but like, I think that this is the one point where I'd say that we do kind of get into the perfect being the enemy of the good, because the question isn't, would the people that I'm thinking of, like grad students and former athletic coaches coming into these schools, maybe some rough edges, but, you know, 1300 SAT, would they do a perfect job? No. The question is, would they do a job comparable to or better than the teachers that we have in these schools now? And I think there's no doubt. Like, I mean, I went to an inner city school. Like, so you're comparing the people that would be in Chicago, East Aurora, Joliet, Rockford, in my regional country, Milwaukee, with these guys over here from the UK grad program or something. And I think that the second set of teachers would do better.
Well, I think you're right. I think you're right. If we do it right and we set expectations properly, and this is why we get back all the way full circle to where I started, and we factor into school choice that the schools that we open up, obviously have some classical schools and Ian Rowe schools and something like that, but that we also have to take into account that we want to set the expectation for parents that, you know, it's, you got to think about it a little differently. You're moving your kid to a better situation. That doesn't mean they're going to automatically be right up to grade level or whatever. So it's a mix of getting the teachers in, setting the expectations. And that's important also. So when the schools get evaluated, and this is why we have to write the bills properly, so that the standards that they're held to, because they're already in one of the states, the ESA rules are written such that if your child does not achieve at grade level within 2 years, if they don't get to a certain level of this test, they don't get their ESA dollars anymore. Well, maybe the reason the mom pulled them out or whatever was they were doing so poorly and they're making progress, but it's not going exactly at the pace that the state wants. And now they're going to take the dollars away from them. Like, we need to write these bills to take into account the reality on the ground of these situations.
So you got in it there, but I got to at least let you make the important point that you make about the way you want to fix this and attack it through the dollars, because very few people are talking about that. And then the last piece that you and Will were going back and forth about whether the teacher would be better at the other school. Maybe they're the same, you know, from a quality standpoint, save for all of the indoctrination and all the other things.
Yeah, so they maybe have a code of ethics they have to abide by, let's say.
Right. So let's let's end with that. How do you think you have an interesting take on how to attack this? And it's through the legislation and the funding and attacking what Congress is doing and how they're funding school. So let's end on that.
So I'm a firm believer in decentralization, meaning like the closer to the community it serves, the better as far as schools and school funding and controls. So right now we have a Department of Education that is just run amok. They're attaching to IDEA money, that's money for special ed, and even for school lunch money, they're attaching Title IX money for the gender stuff. And they're putting states in the, like Tennessee, for example, and others in the crosshairs and saying, you know, you have to do our bidding. They can't mandate a curriculum. That's against the Constitution, but they can tie ideology to money. And so, and then the state constitutions are obliged to their population to abide by the law and provide the lunch and provide the IDEA funds. But if they commingle these funds, then they have to do things that are against what their constituents want. So Tennessee so far is the only state, just happened last week, where the Republicans there said, hang on, let's do a study on what it would cost. How could we do without this money? In other words, could we make it up ourselves for IDEA and lunch and tell them, keep your money? We're not doing the other stuff. Our voters don't want it. We don't want it. We passed a law to keep this out of K-12, and we're going to stick to it, and we'll fund it some other way. And they have to find out if it's legal, like how they're going to extricate themselves from that legally, and do they have the funds to do it? Could they make it up? But they're at least looking into it to sort of defang the federal government and let them run their schools more locally. I think at the state level, too, most urban areas, you'll see that over 50% of your school funding comes from the state, not from your local property taxes. And so I think, you know, localities that are not comfortable with even their state regulations, you need to start thinking about, can we come up with creative ways, and is it legal for us to fund what we want to do separately and tell the state, no thanks, we're not going to do the thing that you are telling us we need to do. But it's going to require people to be really disciplined and sit down with accountants and look at, you know, what the money is kind of pushing into the school. Also, I would suggest that parents and other people who are interested in this start looking at NGO money and materials coming into schools. One of the things that happens is these corporations will come in with big, you know, donated curriculum, donated services, donated evaluations. And then they get you kind of hooked on that and say, oh, you need this and you need that. And now you have to pay us. Oh, and conveniently, Uncle Sam from the federal government is with ESSER money that you can use to pay us for what you call. And there's Miguel Cardona going, I really want you guys to buy this stuff. Now, he was speaking about a couple months ago to school superintendent associations and saying, now it's your task to find sustainable funding sources. We're going to give you the seed money for this, and I want you all to use it. Take the money. And then when you do, you better find some other ways to get it. So the number one way that they're looking to sustain the funding for the mental health stuff in the schools is by having direct billing to Medicaid from the school. And most parents don't know this. They'll go behind the parents' back, just direct bill right out of the nurse's office or the counselor's office, and you'll never know what counseling your kid had, whatever. And this is coming straight from the federal government. So we need to learn how the funding's happening, where the money's coming in, and what's attached to it. What do they want you to do? And then get with your state legislature and your local, you know, school people and say, we don't want this, and we want to find a better way to fund our schools so we can do without it and say no to the strings that come attached to it.
Oh, that's a lot of great information.
I'm sorry. I know it's a lot, but it's about, like, yeah, it certainly beats the heck out of, we're banning DEI.
Yeah. And, you know,
when we're going to ban CRT. Good luck with that.
When he mentioned Corey, I was thinking our buddy Chris Rupo, too. Like, legislation was good and pushing back is good, but they just twist the language. And all I can think, well, I mean, we covered a lot of stuff, so I just hope that people will, if they don't take anything else away, that Ian Rowe has a great school in New York, so go apply at Vertex Academies.
Please open some in North Carolina so I can have a job.
Hope he moves, opens a school in North Carolina so Deb can get a job. And the DOE, I tell people this is another opportunity to do this since you talked about decentralization. I tell people to go look up the DOE because they make fun of the Republicans every 4 years. One of the candidates for presidents will say, the first thing I do is get rid of this department. They laugh like, one, you're not getting rid of the department. That part's true. You're probably not going to be able to. But also they laugh because they say, we really need it, right? So I challenge people every time I do this, somebody looks it up and they're surprised to go look at the mission. The average person thinks the DOE like open schools. They literally build schools and manage the schools. They don't do that. Thousands of employees, lots of money. They don't do anything. So go look that up and you'll be upset. Other than that, just stay aware and spread the information. She is Deb Filmon, the host of The Reason We Learn podcast. Deb, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Saving the day from you commies who let know you can't fuck with me. I got a country to save. God bless the U.S. of A. Land of the free and a home of the brave. God get all of the praise. I got a country to save because I'm Patriot J and I'm saving the day.